This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Good evening. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to Cabinet. We're very happy you could join us tonight for the launch of Mark Derry's And It's Not Big Bad Thoughts. Mark is a phenomenal writer. We're especially thrilled to have him here. I've written a number of pieces for Cabinet, and he reminded me also that we've not seen each other since the conference on nostalgia in Mexico City that Cabinet organized in 2004. Is that right, Mark?
I yield to your more youthful memory.
Mark gave a wonderful talk. And I don't know, whenever I think of Mark, I do think bad thoughts.
I've never been so flattered. It was probably because of my boorish behavior at that conference.
No.
I think I picked a fight with another one of the discussants.
Did you really?
You weren't there.
I'm going to hand over to Mark. Please welcome Mark.
Thank you. Is this loud enough? Can everyone hear me? As I said earlier when they were testing the mic. Oh, louder already. Yeah. As I said earlier, how's that? I'm a frail, consumptive, palely loitering thing and not given to the stentorian tones most New Yorkers seem to broadcast their innermost thoughts with. So thank you, Sina, for that suspiciously terse introduction. And thank all of you for coming. Some of you may know me from lectures at the observatory, just on the other side of the wall, hard by the Gowanus Canal and its charmingly pestilential miasmas. So thanks for joining me tonight by the Wordsworthian idol of the Gowanus. I always expect, like something out of Raymond Chandler's The Lady in the Lake, a gefilte fish, soft cadaver to come burbling up out of the depths and wave its decomposing paddle of a hand at me languidly and then subside back into the bubbling depths. Regrettably, that's never happened. But hope springs eternal. For those of you who were, come on in, there's plenty of seats. You can just come right up front, take a pew. For those of you who were drawn in by, oh, I think somebody's signaling you up here. Yes, there you go. I'm just a matchmaker by nature. They've actually never met each other. Some of you may have straggled in because of the New Yorker announcement, which billed this, I think, rather floridly or ostentatiously or melodramatically or histrionically as a multimedia lecture. The multimedia consists of a few rotting thumbnails about 30 pixels by 30 pixels. So if anybody was expecting, you know, the Deleuzian equivalent of the flute solo in Aqualung, you may want to go collect your money now. So without further ado, I shouldn't maunder on too much because we've already started quite late. I'll wait for the chap with the backpack to settle down or settle in. Okay, got plenty of trail mix and bottled oxygen. I hope. Good. Okay, so we're starting late. But I do feel I need to make a few prefatory remarks. I'm going to speak extempore for, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 3 hours, and about the Ballardian notion of invisible literature. And then I'm going to read and to a lesser degree extemporize on two excerpts from the new book. I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts, Drive by Essays on American Dread, American Dreams, available at better bookstores near you. So, how many of you are familiar with the concept of invisible literature? I'm just curious to know. How many, any Ballardians in the room? Okay, a few. marvelous. So G.G. Ballard, the British SF author, wonks and the people who are devoted to sci-fi become quite exercised on the question of whether it's sci-fi, SF, or science fiction, the same way that Trekkers and Trekkies undergo a myocardial infarction when someone refers to them as Trekkers. Or Trekkies, rather. I say it's spinach, and I say to hell with it. But in any event, Ballard was an SF author. He died quite recently. And one of his most fascinating contributions, I think, to critical theory, to postmodern theory, is the notion of invisible literatures. Invisible literatures, quite simply, are the sort of dream life of 20th century institutional culture. The sort of it's technically known in the field as gray literature, and you can find some of it at the New York Academy of Medicine Library, which I'll be touching on tonight. But it's everything from interoffice memos to a Senate subcommittee white papers to advertising literature to highly specialized journals like the Journal of Forensic Pathology, the Journal of Deviant Psychology, and they have copious collections of these types of specialized literatures at the New York Academy of Medicine Library. And Ballard thought that we should think of these things as invisible literatures, a kind of a subterranean current running beneath what is conventionally thought of as literature in that highbrow New York review of books sense of the word in the 20th century. Ballard hatches this idea between about 1958-1964 when he gets a job at the magazine Chemistry and Industry in London. It's the official journal, it's the house organ of the Journal of the Society of Chemical Industries, right? And Ballard had already viewed science and technology through the prism of surrealism. He was a devout surrealist. And one of his great contributions to SF in the 1960s, along with Michael Moorcock and others, was to bring to bear on science fiction, right, which had been a kind of a petting zoo for ham radio enthusiasts, you know, pencil-sucking, fungal geeks, you know, sort of maladjusted readers of amazing stories by Hugo Gernsback. Ballard makes it cool. He brings to bear the sensibility of Richard Hamilton, the British collage artist, the British version of pop art, which is exploding and swinging London at that point. Ballard stages a gallery exhibition of crash cars and hires a stripper who he bequeaths the sobriquet to Vermilion Sands, which is the name of an interlocked story cycle of his. And she dances, goes sylphing and writhing through the crash cars. As people get drunker and drunker, they're practically moved to gang rape. The entire place is destroyed. One of the cars is demolished. People break all the windows of it, right? So Ballard is clearly turning the SF world on its head. And part of how he does that is by looting the armamentarium of surrealist techniques. And he's thinking about these things when, desperate to earn his daily crust, he gets a 9-to-5 job at the magazine I just mentioned, Chemistry and Industry. By the way, this is Ballard in that period, in case you hadn't recognized him. And it's a kind of a chemical wedding, pun intended, because he's perfect for the job and the job is perfect for him. And so he starts, as he says, sluicing through or chumming through or sort of swimming through like an immense baleen whale, these seas of specialized information, this incredible gout, this cataract of weird technical and scientific journalists coming, information is coming over the transom into his office. And Ballard, as he says, is like some sort of baleen whale going through all this krill and just devouring it. And he starts experimenting with Barozian cut-up techniques, texts assembled from fragments of this material, filled with evocative, pungent phrases like programming the psychodrill, coded sleep in intertime, or mainline climb dialed, L5 on the big roots. And he has to do paste up and layout for the magazines, virtually a one-man or two-man or three-man operation. And so he learned some very rudimentary graphic design techniques. Here's the magazine itself, Chemistry and Industry, the best Talking Heads record title they never used. Far better, I think, than more songs about buildings and food. And of course, it's the world of tomorrow, isn't it always? Those of you who are familiar with Ballard from perhaps his best-known book, and well, best-known after Empire of the Sun, Crash, will not be at all surprised to see that the magazine frequently featured, through no agency of Ballard's, it was simply what he had to do as the editor of this technical journal. They ran numerous features on crash test dummies and impact studies, and that's where Ballard discovered the extraordinary two-volume set, which is available for your perusal at the American, at the New York Academy of Medicine Library, Crash Injuries, Volumes 1 and 2. I love the fact that there it's two volumes. And it really, I shouldn't make light of it. Not only was it sort of a landmark publication in the study of traffic injuries, vehicular injuries, and traffic engineering. But it's also quite compelling reading, and it's kind of ethnographically or anthropologically, in terms of oral histories, there's a number of case studies in it that are really extraordinary. So Ballard surely came across Crash Injuries Volume 1 and 2 at that point. That, combined with the harmonic convergence of these amazing stories that he was required to run, clearly is the fertile loam in which the toadstools of Crash, you know, start sprouting up in his unconscious. Meanwhile, he's got a very close friend, Dr. Christopher Evans, who's a sort of a spectral figure who flits through the history of computer science, but is really an amazing character. And Ballard mythologizes him in his critically neglected sequel to Empire of the Sun, The Kindness of Women, which I commend to all of you. An absolutely spellbinding, exquisitely wrought, you know, lathe-turned book that for once earns that tedious adjective, lapidary, that should be struck from Michiko Kakutani's lips for all time. But in any event, Christopher Evans wrote this book, The Micromillennium, which is forgotten, came out in like 1972, 73, and he has this vision of desktop computing, you know, a radical thing upon the face of the earth. But he was a visionary computer scientist and also a surrealist by nature, very influential on Ballard. Ballard says, for nearly 10 years, or actually an article about them says, for nearly a decade, Evans would send Ballard the contents of his waste paper basket. He worked in the National Physical Laboratories in England, which is to say the National Physics Laboratories, and he would quite literally upend the waste basket, the proverbial dustbin of history, to which he consigned all the technological, sort of techno-scientific effluvia that came sluicing into his office. He would dump it into this box, lash it with duct tape, and drop it into the mails to Ballard. And Ballard was immensely grateful. He says it was wonderful stuff. And many years after Evans's death, and many, many years after he'd received the last of these boxes, he recalled wistfully for a journalist, "I kept it in the coal shed for years. When I finally cleaned it out about 5 years ago, I could hardly bear to throw any of it away. I can't have enough information coming into my life. I want to read everything. I want to eavesdrop in the shop talk of specialists in the field." Okay, so theoretically, in terms of critical theory, what is under the hood, if you will? What are the shadows swimming beneath the surface in invisible literature? Well, let's have the locus classicus. Let's take the juiciest, meatiest quote from Ballard in Research Magazine 8-9, the MAGA book, if you will, the Ballard issue, which is really a canonical work of Ballard scholarship. And there's an extraordinary quote where Ballard talks about Evans's gifts to him through the mails. He sent me the contents of his waste paper baskets, scientific handouts, giveaway magazines, bulletins, printouts that weren't needed anymore, any sort of laboratory detritus. It was a gold mine. It's impossible to exaggerate how exciting these strange crossovers from the communications world were. Psychopathology, experimental applied psychology, commercialism, all those overlaid together provided a wonderful sort of compost which my imagination could feed on. Key phrase there, overlaid together, a sort of a pre-web, pre-digital mashup, right? McLuhan is thoughtful on this point in his sort of avant la lettre, semiotext style, hip pocket paperback, the medium is the massage. He says, when information is rubbed against information, the results are startling and effective, right? So Claude Shannon, the sort of founding father of information theory, talks about this. So does Gregory Bateson, the New Age philosopher and evolutionary biologist who was very interested in information theory. He says, information is the difference that makes a difference. It's the distance between two facts, right? Two things are any individual thing, any individuated thing, sort of floating in a vacuum, is never as extraordinary as the connection between two things, which is kind of extraordinary because, in a way, that echoes figuratively our neuroanatomic structure, right? Things get going in the head in terms of thought processes when they're synaptically connected. It's the connections that make the revelation, that make the inspiration, that make the insight. So I think Ballard is gesturing in that direction. He says that sort of scientific base material is worth its weight in gold. It's difficult to come by. Now, bear in mind, he's talking before the net. And people often sort of are staggered by the fact that when, you know, the interwebs came along, Ballard was utterly uninterested in them, right? He had a girlfriend of many, many years, Clara Walsh, who was his age, and they were together for something like 30, 40 years after the death of his wife, right? And she hilariously would read things on the web and then print them out and give them to JGB. It was this extraordinary thing I found on the web, right? Something kind of medieval about it. But I actually think that, first of all, there's the gravitas of compost, right? If you've ever talked to an investigative reporter, they seem to sort of inhale the fumes of paper. The idea of a paper trail is almost intoxicating. You know, there's something sacerdotal about it. It's, you know, it's almost like the holy wafer, but it's also like, you know, crack rock for the soul, you know. And you talk to a guy like Wayne Barrett at the Village Voice, or late of the Village Voice, and being able to dive into a sea of paper and paddle around is almost intoxicating to those people. So there's that. But I also think that, yes, everything is supposedly instantaneously available to us on the web, but we still need curators and custodians, and you still need to have a sense of sort of agency and volition, and you need to have the desire to think these, to seek these things out, which is to say, in a sense, you have to know about it already before you locate it, right? You have to be the sort of person who wants to read Crash Injuries, Volumes 1 and 2, by way of example. Or, you know, as Ballard says, he says, there's a sort of threshold of accessibility where once one falls below it, one simply sees nothing. I've always been a voracious reader, and here's the moment, the locus classicus, where he coins the term. I've always been a voracious reader of what I term invisible literature. Market research reports, pharmaceutical company house magazines, the promotional copy for a new high-energy breakfast food, journals such as Psychological Abstracts, an Italian automobile magazine, Style Auto, the internal memoranda of TV company, planning departments, sex manuals, medical textbooks, such as the extraordinary Crash Injuries. by comparison with this, this is my favorite part, he moves immediately to a literary critique. By comparison with this, most writers, by which I mean the great majority of English and American novelists, have nothing of interest to say whatsoever. Ballard, I believe, opens the door to a new discourse, the scholarly study of the unconsidered effluvia of the information age, the table rapping of the early 20th century, trans-channeling the unconscious of institutional culture, the lit brute, with apologies to Dubuffet, of the early 21st century. What else might that include? Well, I imagine a Library of America compendium, volumes 1 and 2, printed on high reg content paper with a special silk bookmark included, that is an anthology of Bible tracts, mail order catalogs, Bobo porn such as Smith and Hawken, Restoration Hardware, Pottery Barn, Williams Sonoma, massive book length government reports and white papers such as the Warren Report, the Starr Report, the Meese Report. Daily affirmations, Casket and Sunnyside, the trade publication for funeral directors, psychological tests such as the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Index, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, and now in its, what iteration is it, 5, 6, 7?
Almost 5,
right, a vexed question. Technical manuals, PR company position papers, corporate mission statements, the yellow pages, sex manuals, cockpit voice recordings from black boxes, courtroom transcripts, police station confessions, lunatic fringe manifestos nailed to telephone poles, robot spam considered as surrealist poetry, and of course suicide notes, which Sina insisted I speak about tonight. Betraying a side of him that doesn't bear close inquiry, I think. Okay, so I've rattled on quite enough about this. I'm going to quickly anatomize some of the theoretical, I think, understructure or underpinnings of what Ballard's talking about, and I'm going to try to blow through this at great speed, and then I'd like to read these excerpts that sort of adumbrate or instantiate or sort of embody or offer examples of what Ballard is talking about. So what's going on with this notion of invisible literature? Well, I think, first of all, one thing that should be self-evident to any literary critics in the room, cheers. Is that, oh dear, away from the Mac. And Ballard always was Freudian. Well, only if you'd like to. Is this a priceless tablecloth? Really? Back when Iran was Persia, no doubt. I'm not used to drinking beer. I usually drink martinis. So this is a newfound vice for me. Okay, so what are some of the sort of theoretical dynamics that are rattling around inside invisible literature? Well, first of all, it has to do with reading against the grain or willful misreadings or glosses or subversive or perverse misreadings or overreadings or overthinking, all right? So in other words, this thing that is not literature in any eyes is suddenly transformed into literature sheerly by the critical gaze. That, I think, is kind of extraordinary. And it really puts paid to the notion of the critic as the unweaver of rainbows, the critic as the buzzkill, the critic as, as Wordsworth said famously in The Tables Turned in 1798, we murder to dissect. You never hear the whole passage, which is, our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives, right? So Wordsworth, presumably sylphing around near a, you know, more Arcadian canal than the Gowanus, is thoughtful on the point that, you know, nature has some sort of primacy before culture, And that line, though, is often used as a stick to beat the critic with. Invisible literature suggests that, and we don't need much convincing on this point, I think, since there's so much evidence ever since, you know, at least, you know, Claude Lévi-Strauss, but that criticism can be a form of creation, that interpretation can be a locomotive piston, a sort of an engine generating meaning, right, which is to say a new thing upon the face of the earth, especially if it's, and it seems as if the meaning is quantifiable when the act of the critic bulks large, and never does it bulk larger when the critic is transmuting, you know, crash injuries into the great lost novel of the 20th century. You know, Ballard is fond of saying the Warren Report is the novelization of the Zapruder film, right? You know, or the greatest surrealist novel is the Hollywood Yellow Pages, right? And so the critical intellect that can do that and sell you on it and convince you of that, I think arguably really is creating something, okay? Now, oftentimes, the sort of plebeian or, that's too pejorative, the common, the reflexive, let's say, response to the idea of the critical project of critical inquiry is, oh, you're overreading that, you know? And what could be more preposterous, presumptuous overreading than, you know, reading interoffice memos or the Journal of Deviant Psychology as a species of literature? But the problem with that argument is that all readings are overreadings, right? I mean, from easily, you know, from the structuralist, certainly from Barth on, you know, the presumption is that, you know, the death of the author, that meaning inheres in the eye of the critic. Okay, so all the idea of you're reading something into this, all readings are readings into things. Then John Cage gives us the notion of the cacophony on the street as being part of the string quartet, right? This permeable membrane between the world around the art and the art. Cage actually says the great question for a 20th century artist is not what sound should I make? How can I possibly make a new sound? The question is, why make a sound at all? The world is filled with sounds. So he completely diegetically reframes the question and says, let us start to hear extant sound as art, as music. So there's an amazing sort of positional shift there that I think is really extraordinary. Ballard does this. Delirious overreadings are part of the project of readings, and we see this in Salvador Dali's sort of surrealist exegesis of Millet's Angelus. Now, people say, well, there is still kind of a poverty to the critic, but I actually think what Ballard is doing in his transmutation of these invisible literatures is incredibly edgy, and it inspired a kind of wish fulfillment dream in me of two cultural critics squaring off in a Jeopardy-like duel to the death. An ultimate cage fight for theory jocks, created by studio execs in close collaboration with Judith Butler, Avital Ronell, and Zizek. As an onstage clock clicks, ticks, and inexorably toward the dreaded buzzer, sweaty-browed critics flaunt their deconstructive chops by extemporizing commentaries on pop flotsam, plucking subtext out of thin air. They're given these things without any warning, because I always thought, where's the Top Chef quickfire challenge for deconstructionists? Where is the Project Runway for post-colonial scholars? The bravura acts of textual explication that took critical theory to vertiginous heights in the 80s and 90s always did conceal an intellectual bravura, a Popinjay cockiness. So my imaginary game show would simply render that implicit explicit, challenging contestants to outdo each other with Evel Knievel leaps of intertextuality and a buzzsaw Barthesianism that would go so willfully against the grain of a text's accepted meaning that the original sense would be lost in a sawdust blizzard of contested narratives. All the while, play-by-play analysis from a sotto voce commentator a la Iron Chef would ratchet up audience tension. So that's my little flight of fancy. But I think what Ballard is doing here is